Hello and welcome to Shades and Layers. This is episode 5 of season 3 on creative entrepreneurship. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. This is an ongoing conversation about Black women in entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Kugona Skosana Richie. And if you need to know anything about me, it's this. I love pretty things. I love accessories, furniture, lighting, and maybe the last one is influenced by the fact that I lived in Scandinavia for 13 years where the sun makes an occasional appearance. So I quickly learned about the importance of light in a room. And today's conversation, of course, centers around a company that is known for the beautiful lights that they make for Nando's. It is the Mash Tea Design Studios. And today I am speaking to Tabisa Mjo, who's the designer and founder at the company. She won the Nando's design competition about 5 years ago, and when she made them something called the Tutu Light. And she and her team have been working together ever since. And in this conversation, we not only talk about the various accolades that she's received over the years, but the ins and outs of running a design firm, the challenges and joys of her industry, and we also get deep into the details of how to succeed by nurturing your relationships. I loved every moment of this conversation, and I hope you will too. So here's Tabisa first elaborating on how she would go about describing her work.
I used to say that I view my work as a form of storytelling, and I consider myself a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And design is the medium that I use to tell those stories. And those stories are stories of my own personal history, mm-hmm. my own lived experience, and the experiences and cultural heritage of the people who are in my life, people who are perhaps no longer in my life, but have had an influence and an impact, a lasting sort of impact on me. Yeah. Mm.
So you say you used to say that. What do you say nowadays?
Nowadays I don't say much about it. I design and manufacture lighting and furniture products. Mm-hmm.
What's changed?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just my own sort of growth. Mm-hmm. My growth, particularly in the business side, mm-hmm. of Mash Tea, and really instead of looking at it as just this creative expression, a creative expression, I now really am training myself and have become so much more conscious about treating it as a business, mm-hmm. A design business. That for me is now a priority, to build it into a sustainable and a scalable design business that will outlive me, and that the people that I work with, so all of the artisans and the crafters, that, you know, it will be the vehicle that they use to create income generating opportunities for themselves. Mm-hmm.
So why did you make that shift? Was it a money decision, or was there something else behind it?
Just like experience. Well, I suppose it is a money, not I suppose, it is a money decision. Mm-hmm. Because I've been doing it now seriously for about 4 or 5 years. Well, this is my 5th year. Mm-hmm. And I realized that in order for work to be meaningful, there has to be a tangible change, not only in my own lived experience, but in the lives and the experiences of the people that I work with. It has to present income generating opportunities for myself and for the artisans. Otherwise, what are we doing?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Telling stories is great, but I mean, up to what point?
So how are you structured? How do you work with the people in your immediate creative circle?
So there's sort of different levels, if you will. At the quote-unquote top level, it would be the beaters from Takambile Beat Studio. Mm-hmm. So they are their own entity, and I collaborate with them on really the collectible design pieces. Mm-hmm. And right sort of next to them is Bambi Zulu. And sort of the main person at Bambi Zulu is Mam Beauty Ngongo. Mm-hmm. She is a weaver, like Zulu baskets. And so together with, so myself, Mam Beauty Ngongo, as well as Hotlander, which is another furniture brand, mm-hmm. we created the Hlabisa bench, and that's part of the collectible design section as well of Mashti. And so she is her own entity. Mm-hmm. And then at sort of a second level, I'll have the people that really I work with in-house. And those are the people who make the things that you buy, you know, that are on our website, readily available, that you'll find in stores or restaurants, whether you buy directly from us, the everyday products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I also have sort of partner manufacturers, because we don't have our own manufacturing. And so we have, well, one specific partner manufacturer is called Chandel Lighting. Mm-hmm. And we've been working together now since the very beginning. And so all of the things that, you know, that need machinery,
right,
Chandel does for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And really, it's not even a sort of supplier type relationship. It's literally a partnership at this stage of the game. Yeah.
What makes it a partnership?
Yeah. You know, when I started working with them and only had the tutu, for example, the relationship was very clear, like the boundaries, if you will, were quite clear in that you place an order. We don't develop or anything like that. We make the drawings that you have sent, and it ends there, right? And over the years, I've kept going back, and the business has grown, and the need and the need for their services their role had to expand. Because the more things we were making and the more these things were traveling, they also had to come on board in terms of like, okay, if we are going to be making 100 of these things, we actually have to sit down together and think about how best we can make them so that it's quick, so that it's competitively priced. Because sometimes when you are just a supplier type relationship, they're not invested. They're not necessarily invested in your business, right? And so they won't necessarily like share their own knowledge in terms of, oh, you know, if we actually made this like this instead of that, you would save 10%. Yeah, you could. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right,
they're not
as vested interest in your success.
There's no vested interest, exactly. Mm. Whereas now, after all of this time and all of the work that we've put in, and I think also the consistency, right? Like I'm very consistent.
Right.
Their walls, if you will, have also sort of come down, and they now have such a vivid interest in seeing Mashti succeed. Mm. And
so it's the repeat business and also the potential, of course.
Exactly.
Oh, that's fantastic. And what about the creative part of it? Who comes up with the designs?
So the creative part of it at the moment is all on me. Mm-hmm. But I do have a young man that I work with. His name is Ngwako. Mm-hmm. And Ngwako is a trained industrial designer. And he's always sort of my first point of contact. Once I have come up with an idea and I have a sketch and I'm pretty clear on what it is that I want to make and how it's going to look and what material we're going to use, blah, 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 all of those sort of details, he's then the next person that I will share that idea with. And then he and I will sit together and be like, okay, cool. How will this be made? Right. So where's the joint going to go? Like, what angle are we cutting that frame at? What size bar are we using on this backrest? Those sort of details, because that's his skill set. And then from him, then he'll do the technical drawing. Then when that's done, then it'll go to Shandal, who do the manufacturing. And at Shandal, Chris and I will also then sit, look at the drawing, and he comes in with his own experience. Like, okay, cool, I see you guys are suggesting this size bar, but actually you should really be using this size. Or, you know, like, because ultimately he has more experience than both Marco and I. Yeah, he sees things in a way that we can't possibly see them because of his experience. Mm.
But do you ever clash on that, you know, when you want something very specific because you've seen it?
You've seen it
coming out in a certain way. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the beginning, he used to get quite flustered whenever I'd come up with this, because it's like, oh, what is this now? You know, like, like, Tabs, why can't you just do normal things? Why are you always coming with these funny things? Because it was also a challenge for him. Because, you know, he's been making lights for 30 years. And he's been making pretty standard lights.
Right.
And now I'm coming in with these things, and he's having to engage a different side of his brain. And in the beginning, there was a lot of resistance. But again, I'm very consistent. It's very difficult to to turn me down when I really apply my mind. And so he's come around. And I would even need to say that he kind of enjoys it now, because he's constantly asking, what's next? What's next?
Right.
He also enjoys, like, when I tell him, like, oh, this is now going, you know, like, this order is going to Paris, and this order is going to, I don't know, the States, and this is going to that cool restaurant. You know, he also, you know, I think there's a sense of pride in that, you know,
for him
to know that the work that they're doing traveling, and it's impacting,
it has an audience. Things. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it's also quite good, like, if someone sends him something asking him to make or to quote or whatever, like, he'll be like, he'll always email me or text me, like, oh yeah, this person sent me this, they want me to make them this, but this kind of looks like yours, so no, I'm not gonna do it. So he's also like, he's now developed the eye, like, he can spot things that he like look like mine. You know, I'm not, and I for me it's neither here nor there, but it's just the fact that now he's also so invested.
I mean, there are two things that come to mind as you're speaking. The first one is, you know, what's your edge as a design studio?
So in the beginning, I used to say that I think what really makes Mesh Tea special and gives us the edge is we have a beautiful balance between, like, traditional craft and contemporary design. We meld the traditional craft with technology to create a contemporary South African design aesthetic.
Right.
Actually, I won't even say South African design aesthetic. I'm going to say to create a contemporary design aesthetic, because it can be anyway. And it's not only inspired by South Africa, it's inspired by my lived experiences, which aren't limited to only South Africa, right? Because I also exist in a global village. I also have I'm on Instagram. I have access to all of these things that give me sort of a window into the rest of the world.
Sure.
And so those things, I think, do, and even if it's on a subconscious level, they definitely do influence my output.
Sure.
But the foundation, I think, is obviously always craft. I absolutely love craft. I absolutely admire artisans. I'm completely blown away by the things that people in South Africa, I can do with their hands. Like the one item that I do two items with Gagambi Beat Studio. One of them is a light. It's called the Bright Light. And so we had a client commission one in their own sort of colors. And so the ladies just sent it over the other day. And, you know, when I was, like, unwrapping it and just looking at it, I was just so blown away that the way they interpreted what I had sent them, yet it is exactly what I wanted in my head. It's exactly what I wanted.
Right.
Even I was not able to explain it or to draw it, but they were able to execute that. And I was just saying to us, I was chatting to like the curator at the Gamble, that like, I don't even know how you guys did it, because there's no way I would have been able to explain it.
Mm. But have you been working together for a long time?
Yes, we have been working together since 2017. So I suppose there's also like that element of like, sure. Oh, we know you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that works, right? When you have a relationship with people.
Yeah. Actually, I think for me, it's also like just a testament to them. So I think it's two things. So yes, the fact that we've worked together for such a long time and there's a trust there. Mm. But then it's also about their own incredible skill set and mm-hmm. their own mm-hmm. artists. They are artists. Mm-hmm. Because the level of detail that went into making that light is on another level. It's like their choices are so mind-blowing, and it's choices that I never would have been able to say to them to make. Mm. Something as simple as, here we're going to use a glass bead, and then here, right next to this glass bead, we're going to use a timber bead. And then instead of using this bright yellow, we're going to use a mustard yellow. And then like, simple decisions like that, that ultimately, when you look at the thing as a whole, is so incredibly cohesive, and it invokes the emotion that I wanted to invoke.
That's amazing. That's really, that's a fantastic feeling. Yeah. There is something about people who work with their hands. I don't know. It's just so admirable.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It doesn't get old. And also it's like the patience, because mm-hmm. I don't have that to sit and labor over something, because it takes them 6 weeks. You know, imagine working 9 to 5, 5 days a week for 6 weeks, working mm-hmm. on a single piece. Mm. I mean,
that's amazing. Yeah. The patience. Wow. It's a labor of love.
It's a labor of love. It's a mm. labor of love.
You're listening to Shades and Layers, and my guest today is Thabisa Mjo, founder of the acclaimed Mashti Design Studio in Johannesburg. And I'm convinced that the reason why she's so successful is the way in which she treats her people. She speaks of them with the utmost admiration and respect, and I think that is top class. In this next segment, we get deeper into her work. She starts off by telling us how one of her most challenging designs became part of the Museum of Decorative Arts collection in Paris at the Louvre. We also chat about the proverbial seat at the table, and she tells us where she finds herself in the arrangements of chairs. And what's been the most challenging design for you?
So I think it is, okay, two things. So the first one is the this cabinet, we call it the Giorgio cabinet, mm-hmm. and it has fish scales. And that's been the most challenging because we still are not able to make it as well as we should, right? So technically speaking, it's the most challenging design.
Okay.
I think it's also the most striking because the tree cabinet plus the tutu, you know, those are the two items that are in the Museum of Decorative Arts. Mm. And I think precisely because also the tutu is like, it's just a beautiful piece of work, right?
It's
like
gorgeous,
regardless, you know, whether it's just a pretty thing, right? Mm. Whereas the Giorgio is not necessarily a pretty thing, but it's an interesting thing. And the question that people always ask me is like, how do you guys make this? Like, where are the scales hinged? Like, how are the scales sitting on you? Like, how, you know? And so technically, that's been the most challenging, and it continues to be a challenging because we still haven't simplified the production process of it, you know. Mm. We still haven't resolved it, whereas the tutu is resolved, you know. Like, you wake anyone up at 2 a.m. who works on the tutu, like from the welder to the guy who does the powder coating to the weavers, they'll do it in their sleep. It's right. So like resolved. Giorgio is not resolved. And we all know it's not resolved. And it's hard. It's hard to
get. So if I have to order one now, it might be an issue.
So you'll get it, but yeah. You'll get it like after a struggle. And it's, you know, the reason the tutu is resolved is because we've had the opportunity to make so many of them.
Right.
So we've had the opportunity to resolve. With Giorgio, we've only really made three. Yeah, you need time and you need to constantly making it to really get it to perfection. But unfortunately, we can't afford because it's such an incredibly expensive piece as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not even something that like we can tinker with on the weekend.
And so those two are in the collection in Paris.
Yes, that's correct.
How did that come about?
There is a gallery in Paris called Bon Esperance, and run by this fabulous man, Scott Billy, an American, a wonderful, wonderful human being. And he had lived in South Africa for many years. And as, you know, many people do, like, you know, South Africa, you either like love it and you get hooked or you can't stand it. He was hooked on all things South Africa. So he was living here for a few years, but he wanted to move to Paris and open a gallery that would specialize in South African art and design because it had just impacted him so much. And yeah, and so he approached me, asked if, you know, he could buy pieces of my collection and could I make something new. He would launch his gallery with these items. And so I'm making a tutu because, you know,
it's a signature.
Never failed. It's the trusted. You know, everyone needs that. And then I made him the Giorgio cabinet. And he absolutely loved it. And that first one also wasn't like beautifully made, but the damn thing is so like striking and interesting, it's very hard to resist. So and it's made it for him, and the curators at the Museum of Decorative Arts at the Louvre had gone to his gallery, not to see the tutu, but just to see this new gallery that's opened. And then they saw the tutu and they saw the cabinet, and
love so, at first sight.
I think it might have been. And months later, this process must have taken about a year. They then had to present it to the board to say, you know, here are these things that we want to acquire to be part of the permanent collection. And I had to do a whole sort of story, like what's my background, what inspired the pieces, how are they made, blah, blah, blah. And I did that. I forgot about it because this is one of those things that I never even dreamt about. Like I'm a designer. I'm not an artist. I don't dream about museums. And yeah, then he sent me a text one day, like random, like, out of the blue, like, oh, guess who's the first South African artist, which I'm not an artist, but anyways, like just like, you know, he was so casual about it, but we had a good laugh. You know, it was just like it was a dream I never had come true. A few months before, like the year before I got the text, my mom and I had actually visited the Louvre and seen Mona Lisa and blah blah blah, and then we got next door to the Museum of the Decorative Arts because it's in the left wing of the Louvre. And we absolutely loved it. And actually when we went, they were busy setting up the exhibition that they had for the House of Dior.
Nice.
It was just like, I know, right? It was just like such a, so in the lobby, they're all like these beautiful like Dior gowns that were like being sort of unboxed and, you know, and it was just like such an incredible sort of surreal moment. And never in a million years, in all honesty, did I think that I would be a part of that. That's not even a dream that I had.
Man, life will surprise you in so many great ways.
Right. So when I got the text, you know, and I was explaining to my mom, like, I had to remind her, like, so remember when we went to Paris and then we went to that place? Yes, that's the one. This is the one, you know. And she was also like, wait, what?
So is this a meaningful accolade for you?
It's a meaningful accolade because the museum prides themselves in having the best, in showcasing the best of craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's meaningful. Mm-hmm. Because these things that are made in South Africa, that are inspired by my lived experience as a Black South African woman, as a Black South African woman from rural Eastern Cape, that this story and these things that are made by so many people come together, that all of our work and all of our effort and our best foot forward, this is where it's landed. And no one can take that away from us.
It's really amazing. And, you know, I wanted to touch on the spaces that you find yourself in as a woman. Who are you sitting with at different tables? Who are your peers, etc.?
I think for me, I think for me, because obviously I am like here in South Africa, it's a mixture, right? It's a diverse group. Mm-hmm. There are other Black women like Nguli from the Ninevites, Mpo from the Urban Native, and then there's white men like the guys from Houtlander. There's a doctor and missus who've been in the industry for years. So I don't feel out of place in the South African context, mm-hmm. which I think is probably very shocking to most people, you know?
Yeah.
To hear me say that.
It's a different story, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a completely different story, right? But in all honesty, when I'm just like being honest, my peers are diverse. Mm. We have Black people, we have white people, English speakers, Afrikaans, you know, Xhosa, Zulu. And also, those are also the same people whom I have had I have access to, right? Like I have the privilege of calling up when I need help with something. Mm. You know, like I'm close to the guys from Outlander, for example. We made that Hlabisa bench together with Beauty Ngongo. So I'm always able to call them like, you know, I got a quote for this thing and this is how much they've charged me. Do you feel like, is this, you know, does this seem reasonable? And they're able to say to me, oh, no, this is too much. Like, go back to them and say ABC. And also in that same breath, like, even with the interior design industry, even though in South Africa it is obviously predominantly a white industry, it is white interior designers who spec my products in their big projects, you know?
Right.
And of course, we do have Black interior designers like Donald Numalo, you know, who is so incredibly talented. And I'm sure that experience is different from that side of it as an interior designer going after these big jobs. That's a completely different experience. But what I can say with a Donald who is in that position is that he then, when he gets those projects, those big hotel projects, he does spec Black designers' work in those projects. And so I'm very lucky that I have been very supported in the South African industry, I have to say.
This is Shades and Layers, and up next we learn about Tabisa's childhood and how she would compile her life story and present it to you. But first, we get into the ins and outs of the industry, what's changed since she joined as a professional. Are there still any barriers to entry, for example? I also got her to tell the story behind one of my favorite of her creations, the Alfred Light. But first, let's hear about the South African design landscape.
So, I'm just now thinking back when I entered, so my big break, quote unquote, was the Nando's design competition, right? And of the finalists, as far as I know, I think there were only two Black women in the final, as you know, in the finalists group, and it was myself and Candace Lawrence. She's colored from Modern Gesture, and both Candace and I are still around. Do you know, and this is like 5 years later.
Yeah,
we're still supplying in Nando's, and we're still supplying Nando's with those products that got our foot in the door. So when I was going through the Design Indaba project, there weren't a lot of, as far as I can recall, there weren't a lot of makers, like furniture and lighting design, product designer, let me say that. There were a lot of fashion designers, a lot of jewelry makers, and a lot of graphic designers. And that really ran the spectrum. Black women in photography, I saw, and also black women in fashion, and black women in jewelry. And the black men were in the graphic, you know, graphic design. With the product design, as far as I can remember, there was only one woman, and it was a white girl from Stellenbosch, if I'm not mistaken. I'm also now just quickly just thinking back about the Nando's competition, because they did it again last year, I think it was. And of those finalists, there were definitely more black finalists than ever before. Right. And in terms of black women, I don't remember seeing a black woman as a finalist. No, there wasn't. It was black men in the product design, yeah. But the year before that, Nando's, their competition focused on pattern making.
Okay.
Like textile design patterns. And there were a lot of black women who dominated. In fact, the winner, I think, was a young black woman. Yeah,
that's interesting.
She's just, it is interesting, right? There's a, I think that's a whole other conversation as well, in terms of like, what do black women feel, not feel, what they have access to in terms of the realm of possibilities. Can I as a black woman make furniture? Can I as a black woman design furniture? If I design furniture, how do I even begin to navigate the world of manufacturing? Because I think that's the biggest stumbling block, aside from obviously how to, who is going to buy these things that you're making.
Sure.
But it's the making. I battled a lot when I started. In fact, with the tutu, the only reason I was able to eventually make the tutu is because Andrea and Megan, two white women from a company called Anatomy Design, and they make beautiful lights. They're the ones who introduced me to Crystal Chandal, and they basically like we see the potential. Like, if you make this first one, if you make this prototype for her, we are sure that this thing is going to take off, and it will pay off. And it won't just be a once-off design. Like, you don't have to set up all of these jigs and figure out how to make this thing just for one. Because with manufacturers, that's what puts them off. When you come with a new idea, the fact that they have to set up an entire new system to make one thing is a very big ask, because it's expensive. And so Megan and Andrea at Anatomy Design, because they were already clients of his, they were my guarantors, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, you need advocates.
You need advocates. And they were right. It has paid off. You know, it's more than paid off for him, you know, for having made the first one. And so I think definitely manufacturing in South Africa is an incredible stumbling block. And I think also people say a lot, why are these things so expensive? And I understand, because I too am a consumer, and I love South African products. Like, I want to fill my entire house with things that are designed and made here, because they really are world class. But it's like, shucks, I have to buy one thing every like 6 months, you know, because things aren't cheap. So I understand from the consumer perspective, but also as a maker, I understand why it costs what it costs, because we are not doing huge production runs. If I was making 1,000 tutus at a go, I would be able to sell a tutu for 1,000 rands.
Right. So but the economies of scale are not there yet.
The economies of scale are not there. And also the handmade element, which people love. People go Google Gaga over the handmade element. That's why.
But do they want to pay for it?
Exactly. Because the person, the artisan who is sitting there, who is not only sort of the thing that they are pouring into that end product, is not just that week that they spend making the thing, but is their years of experience. So when you take home a tutu, or when you take home a bright side table, or when you take home a flute table, it's not just that because that one artisan sat there for a week and made your flute table. No, it's the years of experience, the years of education. Yeah. That's what you take home. That's what you're paying for. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's value in that. Absolutely. So I wanted to find out, speaking of, you know, artisanship, the story behind the Alfred lights. And I am partial to the Alfred lights because they are my favorite of your products.
I love the Alfred light as well. I love the Alfred light. Okay, so we don't normally make custom orders or custom designs because it takes time, it's too expensive, blah, blah, blah. But our biggest client is Nando's. Mm-hmm. And so one of their designers, Elizabeth from Tin Lab Design, she reached out to me, and she and I have worked on many Nando's projects together. Mm. She reached out to me and said, would you ever be interested in making lights out of telephone wire? And I said to her, no, absolutely. It's actually been on the cards because with Bambi Zulu, because I work a lot with Bambi Zulu. That's how I got to know Mam Beauty Ngongo. Mm. So Bambi Zulu also, they in their stable, if you will, they have telephone wire weavers. Well, they have one telephone wire weaver, Alfred. And so we always said, we're going to do something. Mm. But the time just hadn't happened. So Elizabeth says to me, okay, I'm working on this project for Nando's. We're doing this restaurant. I'm going to need about 10 lights, telephone wire. Let's design something together. And she just basically wanted a flat, a disc. She wanted a disc. Mm. She wanted, like, when she explained it, she wanted it to feel like this thing is floating. And when the customer looks up, they see this incredible pattern. Like, wait, what? Where is this coming from? Like a surprise. Mm. I am not a person who is naturally gifted with patterns.
Right. So this was a challenge, like, for you too. Okay.
It was a challenge. Elizabeth was like, I want you to design a pattern. I was like, oh, no. She's like, no, no, no. I want you to design a pattern. So it was absolutely a challenge. So that was challenge number one, designing a bloody pattern. Mm. But actually, when you look at it, all it is just a flower.
But a pretty one.
A pretty flower, thank you. Well, it's just a flower. And then second challenge was now to get Babunduli to make this thing. Now, Babunduli, his own work. So he makes pots, very, very small, beautiful pots, but very small, minimal patterns, no patterns really. You know, his things are more graphic. He's more about lines, very restrained. He uses bright, vibrant colors, but it's restrained. Mm. So he had to make he had to learn to make a pattern, one. Two, he had to learn to make a pattern on a big scale because the light is 600 diameters. Whereas Babuntulu, his own personal work is about, I want to say about 200 to 250 diameters.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. Okay, that's
with a very large, minimal pattern. Yeah. But he was up for the challenge. He made the first one. He made a small sample, like a coaster size. Mm. And it seemed to be fine. Like, he got the proportion right. But in retrospect, of course, he got the proportion right because it was tiny, like a coaster.
Yeah.
So now, client approves everything. They love the pattern, blah, blah, blah. Go for it. Now he has to make the actual order. Two things. He has to make it to scale, one. Two, now there's an actual deadline. And that's another thing that I have learned, that with working with artisans and things that are handmade, but working to a deadline is a whole other challenge. It's a whole other discussion that...
Oh my gosh. The pressure.
You have no idea. You have no idea. And he has to keep making and remaking and remaking, because scaling the pattern, scaling up the pattern and keeping the proportions right so that it looks the same way at 600 diameters as it did on your coaster, those are two completely different things. He was exhausted and exasperated.
Shame.
Was exasperated. And Bamduli had two assistants that he was working with, two young men. Those young men were like, okay, bye, thank you. Thanks, but no thanks, we're done. We're not doing this. Because again, it always seems easy from the outside looking in. You know, when people see the things, they're like, oh, my grand could do that or whatever.
Yeah.
But when you are in it and you are not doing it as a hobby and there is a standard, it's not that easy.
You have to shift things.
Different side of your brain, you know? And so Bamduli's two young assistants quit and they fall. They're in Stanger. I'm in Joburg. So they have to keep sending pictures. If you send me a picture and the thing is not to scale, I can't even bother sending it to the client because I know the client is going to be like, no, this isn't right. And clients are spending a lot of money on these things. So I love the story. The story is heartfelt and it's beautiful, but the product needs to live up to the story.
It needs to live up to it.
You know what I mean? And so it took forever. We missed the deadline. It was a whole big thing. But thank God, because I have a relationship with Nando's. You know, they know that, you know, we're not people who take chances. We're not people who don't do what we say we're going to do. We always deliver on time. But the lesson that I had to learn from this was that if you are doing a new thing and you're doing a new thing with a new material, with a new artisan that you don't know, whom you don't know, because I don't know him. I don't know how he works. I can't let the first one, the prototype, be for a project. I can't. It's not fair on the client, but most importantly, it's not fair on the artisan. Because Bamduli, it was so difficult for him because he also did not like letting everyone down. Because he too is a professional. He too has been doing this for 20, 30 years. And he's known. He's known, you know, people in the industry know him for his telephone wire. But now he was not delivering. And the only reason he wasn't delivering because it was a new thing. And the amount of time was, it turned out to be unreasonable.
Sure.
He underestimated it, of course, because he did coaster size and it was quick and easy to find. I should have said to him, fine, you've done it on a coaster, fabulous. Now I need you to do it to scale, a 600 diameter, and let's see how long that will take you. And then go to client and say, sorry, ma'am, we won't be able to deliver in 6 weeks. We need 12 weeks.
Right.
That's when I drop the ball.
Right.
But that's business.
Yeah. You learn as you go along. You have talked about your mom quite a bit in interviews, and you say that she's your hero. Why is that? Tell me about her.
I think my mom is one of my heroes because she is brave. And it's that bravery that I admire. Because when I think about everything that I have done thus far, yes, obviously there's a lot of grace. And it's also, I have not been afraid of failing. I have not been afraid of rejection. And I think it's that bravery that I witnessed in my mother.
Right. So what are your top three memories from childhood?
So definitely, like, you know, going to KZN and that sort of nostalgia. And I was like always in boarding school from like grade three. So I loved, I'm one of those weird people, I suppose. I loved being in boarding school. I loved being around children my age or other people my age. I loved being around people from different backgrounds. Like, you know, like we all come to it with our own experiences and we would always form friendships that have lasted to this age. Those people that I met when I was a child, and I think it just taught me how to live with people and how to negotiate.
Boarding school, I know.
So I think that whole boarding school experience is definitely a cool, fond memory that I have of my childhood. And I think also just in my own home where I always felt like we were heard. My parents would ask our opinion of things, like when they had big decisions that had to be made. And like, I remember my dad like would specifically ask, like, Thabisa, what do you think? Thokoza, what do you think of this decision? And so we always felt like we were heard, and that our opinion mattered, and always had like the best conversations, debates, heated debates. You know, and we're never told to like shut up or you're wrong or whatever, you know. So
you mattered.
We mattered. Yep. We were seen. Yeah. Mm.
What are your dreams for yourself going forward?
I want to really like establish Mashti Design Studio as a sustainable, scalable business that will outlive me, a business that the people whom I work with can be a platform for them to also not only express their talent and share their gifts with the world, but to, you know, for it to make their lives easier, to generate income. And I would love, and you know, I just love for our products to really be sold all over the world and to be accessible, you know.
If you had to write a memoir, what would it be called and why?
I think it would be called If Faith Could Move the Mountains. If Faith Could Move Mountains. Because I think I am not... It's not that I am so much more talented than the next person, but it's that I keep going. And I keep going because I believe that by keeping going, I'm like preparing. And so when that opportunity comes about, I am prepared. And I'm able now to seize that opportunity because I'm preparing. And so when faith comes in, it's that it's in the consistency. I believe that by consistently preparing, the opportunity will surely come about.
And you'll be ready for it.
And I'll be ready for it. Yes.
Fantastic. Thabisa, thank you so very much. You have no idea how much this means to me. I really was looking forward to this. So thank you for taking the time out. And sure. I'd like to send people your way. Where can they find you?
MashtiDesignStudio.com.
Perfect. That is all from me for this week. Thanks, as always, for listening. And I encourage you to hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast listening app. You can also stay in touch in between episodes by following at Shades and Layers podcast, one word. I'm your host, Kutlwana Skhosana Richie. And until next time, please do take good care.